Okay, so today on the Loopcast, I'm from an undisclosed location. I can't tell you where it is, but there's plenty of booze. So today I'm talking to Matt, the co-pilot of Drunken Predator, and Kelsey. If you are interested in reading about drones and UAVs, I would probably start with Kelsey's writings in the Popular Science. It's good stuff, it's accessible, and you should probably check it out. I'll have a link for everybody. I'm going to start off with establishing a bit of history on UAVs. Mostly because I think it's a history that nobody has really thought about and nobody has written. You know, there isn't, there's no Stephen Ambrose writing the history of drones.
Yeah, it'd be great, though.
Dude, don't steal my book idea.
I mean, Stephen Ambrose would have to come back to life somehow. Yeah. As a
cyborg.
As a
we got it. We
or
got
a cyborg. Anyway, there's no common history, so I really want to start there and look at UAVs as a historical phenomenon. So, I mean, where would you guys start? I mean,
he's going to start with the Kettering bug, and I fully support that.
I was going to say we're going to start with the Kettering bug. The Kettering bug is an aerial torpedo from World War I. It sort of worked in that it flew and it exploded. It worked less well in that it went where you wanted it to and exploded when you wanted it to. That's the Kettering bug. And it's interesting because the Kettering bug is the common ancestor, really, of both drones and cruise missiles. And there will be things, and you'll see them in modern day, and people talk about things like kamikaze drones. And that's weird because the two diverged wildly. Most drones after the Kettering bug are reusable, or designed to be reusable, whereas cruise missiles and flying self-propelled weapons are one-shot. And that's the big difference there. But the Kettering bug is the start.
Yeah. I think the modern term, so the term drone, after the Kettering bug into World War II, Vietnam, generally described unmanned target aircraft. The kind of thing that you would paint bright orange, fly it over the Gulf of Mexico, and have, you know, Maverick Jr. train on shooting out of the sky.
Or even in World War II, there's this fantastic picture of Marilyn Monroe was assembled
yes.
the drones, assembled, I believe it was, I think it was a radio fly or something.
Yeah.
She assembled the drones in World War II. That was when she was noticed as assembling drones in California in World War II. And they were targets for the Navy to shoot at. So they were not designed for a long use, but they would fly back and forth so you could figure out how to shoot something out of the sky.
Right.
And they made a loud droning noise.
Which became
the name. And they were stupid, too. They were these early drones, especially the World War II ones and even the Vietnam ones. They would fly like a set path. You would pre-program it in a rudimentary way, or you would radio control and had very little means of moving. But we'd go out, come back, and if it wasn't shot down, you would use it again.
So I think the modern use of the term drone has started to apply to what are now really remotely piloted aircraft. You have an aircraft that has the capacity to carry weaponry, to have a communication system on board, to communicate the information that it gathers up through a satellite link back to people on the other side of the world. People who operate in this world hate the word drone with a fiery passion.
At AUVSI, which is the drone lobby, they won't say that, but they're the drone lobby. Their press room at their big conference, the Wi-Fi password was don't say drones. Needless to say, every media person working there, of which I was one, wrote about how their password was don't say drones. It's a losing effort. It's what people know. The term is really broad, but every other term put forth is stupid and long.
Yeah.
There's unmanned aerial vehicle. There's unmanned aerial system, in case we forget the fact that vehicles don't move on their own and they're piloted by someone. There's remotely piloted vehicle and remotely piloted system for the same reason. The Air Force likes that one because it has pilot in it. There's multiple tiers and classifications of this. You look it up. There's the Air Force has 5 tiers. The Army and the Marines have 3 tiers with sub-tiers between them that don't overlap. It's stupid and broad, so every single one of these things is going to be called drones because there's no other good term for it. It would be like referring to every single different armored vehicle as a, like, this is a tracked rolling ground puncher cannon platform. We call them tanks.
Yeah.
We're calling these drones.
Yeah. It's, and I think part of the reason why it's such an unproductive battle for people who work within this industry, with whom I, you know, often sympathize and support, it doesn't make any sense to start a conversation with the broader world by essentially telling them, you can't even speak our language. You can't we don't even agree on what to call this thing in the first place. It really sort of sets a torch to any common ground you might hope to build with the people you're trying to communicate with.
And the formidable task they have as an industry is that drones themselves and public consciousness, it's also worth noting that the modern drones really have been developed over the past 20 years, and they've really caught the public eye from their use in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and specifically their use, and then later in dirty wars in, like, Yemen and Somalia, but specifically in their use in targeted killing campaigns. So people know that there's flying unmanned vehicles, they know that they know of the military ones, and they know that this is how they've been used, and they're calling them drones. And if you're going to start saying, no, we have to use the military's own term, there's already so much hostility that you're just alienating every possible audience by not accepting the right words to start with.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of can understand why drone is so insulting. I mean, like, as a biologist, you know, drones are bumblebees that basically work hard and then they die. Actually, they mate and then whatever.
Sure.
And then in software, you know, drone is basically something that just keeps doing the same thing over and over again. Maybe, you know, it gets better as it goes along, but it's basically automation. So I'm sort of curious, I mean, how do we, given those two definitions of work hard, then die, automation till the end, and, you know, automation forever, how do we differentiate those categories against these flying robots? I mean, are they robots? Are they tools?
They definitely... I can't remember where I heard this definition, but it's a good one. And let me apologize in advance if I'm quoting this without citing, you know, whatever smart person said this first. But I've heard robots defined by three criteria, which is that they have the ability to perceive the environment around them. They have the ability to understand that environment in some limited capacity, to comprehend it and to analyze it, and then to use that analysis to affect that environment around them. An example with, a predator drone, for example, might be that the predator drone understands that it is controlled by a radio or by a satellite link, and that it's that predator primary satellite link. If that is cut off, then it comprehends that it can't talk to home anymore, and then it says, okay, now I have to do something to respond to this, which in the case of a predator drone is to fly what's called a lost link platter. So the thing gets that it's out of touch with home base, and it understands the world around it, and it takes some action response, flying lost link. That's a very basic example, but I think it goes to your point about whether the term drone is accurate. It's not. The term drone is sort of demonstrably inaccurate when you're talking about a multi-million-dollar system like a Global Hawk that requires, you know, a small battalion of intelligence analysts and engineers and pilots and, you know, all the rest to fly. You know, no, it's not a drone in that it's not just operating on its own. It needs a lot of constant human input to accomplish its mission. But it's really a semantic argument because, you know, that ship has sailed. This is what we're calling it. Let's get over the fact that that's what we're calling it, and we can acknowledge that there are a lot of different types of drones, which has implications for foreign versus domestic policy. It's, you know, it's gets under one's skin when you see a $300 quadcopter that you bought from Brookstone put in the same category as an MQ-9 Reaper, which is packing enough surveillance gear and munitions to wipe out three city blocks. So are those two things similar in anything other than the fact that they're remotely piloted aircraft? No, but they get lumped into the same category. And you have folks walking down the street who, if they don't know anything else about the policy area, will think that in the next year, the FAA is going to allow their local sheriff's department to start flying Global Hawks and Reapers, which is demonstrably untrue.
But it's also interesting because I've been following the FAA for a long time, and the way they're treating that and the way they're working on it is up until the 2012 FAA reauthorization, the FAA didn't acknowledge drones larger than model airplanes as a thing that was real. They have on the law right now, there's laws governing how you fly model airplanes. There's tentative guidelines for how they want to figure out smaller drones, and then there's more rules for bigger ones. But there's a new category that exists for small vehicles that are smarter than model airplanes. And people have gotten in trouble. There's a big legal case with a guy who flew one for photography purposes over a university in Virginia and maybe buzzed people over their heads and maybe flew dangerously close to a helicopter landing pad. He
yeah,
was not a
that was
great,
the real problem.
Not a real great case of a guy. But he was doing it, and under model airplane laws written, he was sort of okay, but not under anything governing aircraft, and there's a big void here.
Yeah, he would have been smoked if he'd tried to make any money off it, or if he'd been doing it for the local police department, but because he was doing it on his own for fun, you know, he can actually make a literal federal case out of the whole thing.
Right, and so people are talking about this drone, though, and the drone he was flying was no bigger than 3 feet across.
Yeah.
Then I'm sort of curious then about the legal debate, then, because this does bring us to, you know, the use of drones overseas versus the use of drones over here. Like, here you've described sort of a somewhat of a legal debate that's going on domestic use. But I'm sort of curious of looking at, first, the use in places like Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. And sort of looking at, you know, what are some of the sort of laws and policies governing drone use in those circumstances? Well, where you don't have an FAA and you have sort of the war on terror, those rules governing the use. Yeah.
I don't know specifically about the way the military governs its airspace. Matt might be able to speak, but I can't speak more to that. But what I can tell you is that one of the really interesting things about drones that is wildly overlooked is that if we're just talking here about the use of military drones abroad, first I want to say that the vast majority of what they do is mainly surveillance. They're watching, they're scanning vast swaths of rugged or rural terrain to spot people coming towards villages or coming towards soldiers. They're doing basic patrolling from on high. That's the majority of what they do. Then the targeted killing program is a separate thing, sort of branched out of that. But that's something done legally with the permission, explicit or tacit, from the countries it's happening in. Now, Yemen's government isn't particularly representative of its people. It's not particularly a government. There's a lot of problems there. But as international law is structured, the sovereign government, what is the sovereign government of Yemen, allows the U.S. to fly drones over there. And so it's cleared under that, and then they negotiate on the lower levels. Or if there are no lower levels at all to negotiate, they figure that out. In Pakistan, too, this is often the case. Pakistan gets really angry about drone strikes. They're entitled to be angry about drone strikes, except they also let the drones strike. Pakistan's Air Force is designed for fighting another comparable power, another country comparable in power. They could shoot drones out of the sky easily. Drones, as of yet, are really, really bad at air-to-air combat. I think there's maybe one confirmed kill from a drone with a sidewinder in a rock, but that's...
Oh, no, we tried to, in the 2003 invasion,
right.
Somebody strapped what was essentially a modified Stinger missile to the undercarriage of an MQ-1 Predator and flew it against an Iraqi, I think it was a MiG-25, and the thing just blew it right out of the sky. If you ever want to, you know, I think back in... Drones are so bad at air defense that, I mean, the Predator, which is our modern drone platform... In 99, I think, during the Kosovar War, it was the Serbs flew a helicopter along the side of a Predator drone, just popped the door open, hung a machine gun off the side, blew the thing out of the sky. And the technology hasn't changed that much, right? As Kelsey's saying, drones, American drones, the way technology currently operates, unless you're talking about very advanced surveillance, require the permission of the host country. They have to have air superiority already established, which is the kind of thing that makes F-22 pilots and F-35 program managers feel all warm and fuzzy inside, because they get nervous when they see, oh my god, everybody's doing everything with drones. Well, right now, drones still really require fighter pilots and air defense systems to make sure that where they operate, nobody is trying to knock them out of the sky with, you know, a ground-based air defense
particularly
system.
Particularly large rocks.
Yeah, particularly large rocks. It's really, for even a kind of a second-rate air force, it's really not hard to shoot down the current crop of American drones. It's going to change, but as it stands
Why is there a lag in defense then? I mean, is it because there's no
It's not a lag in defense. The fact is, we just choose to operate them over countries that tacitly allow us to be there.
It's also really interesting that drones have been seen as this quintessentially modern weapon of war, and what we've been, the wars we've been fighting work really well for the kind of things drones do. Drones stay airborne for long times with lots of cameras. I mean, well, with the Predator, one really good camera, and then with later platforms, more and more cameras, scanning an area. We're looking for small movements, small groups of people moving at great distances towards us, or we're looking to see over the next hill broadly for soldiers or Marines on the ground. And that's something, we're not worried about fighting enemy armor columns, we're not worried about fighting massive anti-air ever, or even, or enemy aircraft. The Air Force does that fine with their superiority, or the Navy, or even the Marines when they feel like it, or when small enough, they knock that all out. That's fine. Then the skies are clear, and we put drones up to watch for people on the ground with small arms. That's the kind of war that the drones we have right now are really, really good at. Lots of other varieties of war they will be bad at until they get better or do other things. But because we've been fighting, because the conventional part of the war, where like Iraq could command tanks against us and had an air force, lasted a couple months, if that.
Which one?
Oh, 2003. The one we had drones for.
Like 3 weeks.
3 weeks. It was not. So that was the part where we didn't use drones a lot.
Right.
And then, because the rest of the war, where it's small groups of people who we don't know going around setting bombs or attacking us with, like, AK-47, small arms like that, that's what drones do.
Yeah. I mean, do you think then, like, sort of more state-oriented adversaries, let's say China, Iran, whomever, I mean, it seems like then drones are very much very good in only one sort of limited context. I mean,
the drones we have now.
Yeah, we're working to change that. So if you're familiar with the work that Northrop Grumman has been doing with the X-47B, this is a carrier-launched next-generation technology prototype where, Maverick, wherever he is feeling really bad looking at this thing, because this has the potential to be a carrier-launched air-to-ground, air-to-air fighter bomber, which could be, if not a replacement, at least a significant next-generation supplement to aircraft like the F-18 or the F-14. And so the X-47B is really cool, but it's Northrop's and the Navy's attempt at setting the groundwork for something called UCLASS, which is the unmanned carrier-launched surveillance and strike program.
Yeah.
And this is going to be a really big drone that only recently the Navy has been expanding the requirements for this thing. So it's got to be stealthy. It's got to be able to refuel air to air. It's got to be able to pack a ton of punch. This is the kind of thing that China should be worried about if it gets built the way it should. This is the kind of thing that Russia would be worried about. And these countries, especially China, have been building their own drones. So right now it's really a good counterinsurgency, lightly contested airspace, if at all contested airspace, surveillance tool. The next generation of these things will hopefully be able to fight and win in a contested environment.
That's the plan. That brings back to, there's a lot, every now and then articles come out, like, this is China's new drone, or my favorite is when they come up with, like, a new Iranian drone, or, like, this is a drone insurgents coupled together. None of those.
Iran is the onion of drones. It's like they just make shit up. It is wonderful to watch.
They have multiple times photoshopped other countries' drones and released done press releases that this is our new drone. It's like that was in the German air show 4 years ago.
Yeah.
But it's ours. That was the exact angle. You removed the flag from the back. But people will write articles and they'll freak out and Max Boot will have a hissy fit or whatever. That this is the kind of thing that America should be afraid of. And that assumes that the American Air Force doesn't exist and that we would let other countries fly into our airspace. This is the other thing where, like, when... And this is where it's really complicated. With we're talking about the rules of how drones work. Drones work where they have permission to work, or where the country, there isn't a country that can deny them that. So during the war in Iraq, the long insurgency part of it, Iraq, there was no group that could contest the airspace of Iraq that chose to. So we had drones there. Same with Afghanistan. When we were no longer based in Iraq, we had less of that option. We put them where the government lets us. The government might not be encouraged. The people, the government of Pakistan certainly isn't in the best interest of the people in Fatah. But they let us put the drone there, and that's the really complicated law thing. And then we come back to the state side, and drones operate right now out of military bases with federal authority and pretty a somewhat limited range for where they go, for what those do.
And that's where you get... I wouldn't say it's the confusion, but sometimes the conflation between the policy and the platform. A lot
Absolutely.
Of the time, you will have people protesting drone use overseas when, you know, they're really upset about America's drone wars. You know, America's drone wars this, America's drone war that. And these people have, despite what you're, you know, policy quibblings might be, they have a pretty ironclad case of concern of the United States seems to have the ability to kill who it wants, where it wants, when it wants to, so long as that host country is either not contesting it or actively allowing it. And that's a big policy question. But big policy questions don't turn people out into the streets. Big policy questions that are kind of, you know, nebulous and happen in countries we can't find on the map and involve complicated tribal loyalties and weak governments and all that stuff, yeah, it doesn't really get people charged up. But if you tell people that America is using killer robots to bomb terrorists and it's doing it illegally and it's creating the next generation of insurgents, well, holy shit, people will get out of bed for that. And so while, you know, what that has, the second order effect of that has been that I think a lot of people, that drone has become a bad word. That because we have so much secrecy surrounding America's drone campaigns, because they were originally launched under the authority of the CIA in Pakistan,
right.
People assume that they are secret, that they are kind of vaguely malevolent, and that they are representative of American power run amok. And I'm not in any way trying to wade into those policy concerns. They're certainly massive. But, you know, right now, all I'll say is, as the human co-pilot for the Predator drone account, right now, the drones are not making the policy decisions on their own. You know, it's that's a while away, and hopefully it never comes. But, you know, there's a distinction between the policy of targeted killing, you know, secret covert operations in foreign countries with murky authorities. Therefore, it's not. The robots aren't friggin' doing it on their own.
So I'm sort of curious then, what happens to the modern pilot, to the, you know, to the flyboys, to the guys?
Really angry and fights for his share of the budget.
is that what happens?
Bandwagon behind the F-35.
Yeah, the answer is the F-35.
Wow.
It's somewhat more complicated than that. I've spoken to helicopter pilots who, like, that's the service that people are gonna imagine will have pilots in them the longest, because no one wants to get evacuated by a robot.
They're working on it.
Yeah. I wrote about this last week. A prototype
transformer
truck helicopter that can fly out unmanned and load up people from load up casualties and fly them back to base. So they're working on it. They're working on these things, but you're gonna. The modern pilot, really, what's going to happen to the modern flyboy is there's talk that the last fighter pilot has been born, and that's probably true in America. I imagine other countries, and there's still a lot of things. The networks, the satellite uplinks and the communications networks and logistics that go behind this are a lot more complicated than a vehicle that responds to a throttle immediately that you're sitting in. So there will be some use for that for a long time. But what really, the modern flyboys are going to be sitting in cockpits in Nevada for battlefields elsewhere. That's really what it is. It's the flight simulators. We'll have that. Aircraft that require people to be on them, like jetliners too, is probably one that's going to have pilots on the longest. A lot of what they do, autopilot, fly-by-wire, very highly automated, way more automated than we give it credit for. The pilots take off and they land.
Yeah.
More or less. And then most of everything else there is the machine running itself. But we'll put pilots on them because we already have people on them, so why not? But fighter pilots, I would not expect to see us with fighter pilots in a few decades, honestly.
Yeah, the sort of, you know, the joke is referring to fighter pilots as, you know, the white scarf crowd, you know, the leather jackets, the aviators, the Maverick crowd. The view that has been put forward by at least the naval aviator community, as evidenced in a recent foreign policy article that I remember coming out, is the idea of kind of a hybrid force where you'll have unmanned aircraft taking some of the heat, perhaps doing some of the suppression of enemy air defenses missions, going along with manned aircraft, kind of flying in, you know, in a mixed team. That seems, for 5 years ago, that would seem like an unthinkable compromise for that crowd. I think maybe 10 years from now, that may seem to be an anachronistic, you know, nostalgic view of how we ought to be fighting wars. We're really averse to investing human pilots and human warfighters in areas where we don't absolutely have to, but we also occasionally need to blow shit up. And it's, if you have, you know, an unmanned system that can fight and survive in a contested environment, this is where the policy versus platform people may have something of a point. Your barrier to entry for conflict may come down. You may be more willing to launch that airstrike. You know, if you've got a real advanced system like a U-class waiting for you, then they'd argue, hey, sometimes you might be more willing to launch that airstrike if you know that there is no fighter pilot other than the guy who's sitting in the control station in Nevada.
I mean, does that change the... There's a couple questions here. I mean, does that, A, sort of change the relationship of the policymaker to war? If it's really easy to do something, why the hell not? I mean, why not send the drone to blow shit up?
Well, that's... I mean, I'm actually going to... Cruise missiles are a good parallel like this, because drones now are about where cruise missiles were 20 years ago. Maybe even like 30 years ago. And cruise missiles are... They're similar technologies involved, because they have their own guidance systems. They adjust their flight. They fly to... some of them have satellite uplinks and fly along that path. Some of them have pre-programmed GPS. But they fly low. They fly clever. They're designed to not be shot down. Go to a target, and we can hit them from 900 or so miles away. Good. Can I get an optimal win?
Yeah. Oh, no, we're out.
Where are that? I'll have another 312.
We actually got on drop now, so...
Can I have another one, 312?
Okay, I'll
talk about that. Okay. You
didn't
care? No, I'm good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, besides the beer...
This is an essential component.
It is an essential component.
One question in favor to ask you. I've been here all day, and I'm trying to go home.
Okay, we're back.
The bar needed tending.
Best
so
undisclosed location ever.
If the undisclosed location involves a full service bar, then I really feel like we've got that much on Raven Rock. We've got that much on Blue Mountain or Blue. What is it? Bluemont? Mount Weather. That's it. That's the other
don't
one.
Even. So cruise missiles. Cruise missiles were seen as another tool where presidents could commit to use force and use that and strike targets without putting people on the ground. Those are launched. They're Navy launched. You can launch them from submarines. They don't even have to know that the submarine is there, really. We tried to get Bin Laden with them. Cruise missiles aren't perfect.
Yeah.
There are a lot of failings with them. They're not nearly as accurate, but there's a lot of limitations to cruise missiles. We didn't have the right timing. The time it took from launching to hitting the target was big. And we used them... We didn't use them on their own in circumstances, or we used them with airstrikes. But the cruise missile age, the fears, I've read articles from the time predicting cruise missiles as a threat that could crash into the White House if some rogue state wanted to, if Saddam could get someone close enough.
You can't see me rolling my eyes, but I am. They are that notion.
Right, so it's the kind of thing where the things that make the weapon work, in a lot of cases, was having people know it was good intelligence on the ground for where the target was figuring it out, was having the right target in mind, and then realizing that there was a goal that could be achieved with a single strike. You could, in theory, kill bin Laden with a single strike. We did it later, we did it decades later with people. But the core behind that was like you have to have the intelligence in the background on it. And drones, you still have to have the intelligence in the background on it to make targeted strikes work. And that's really what the cruise missile let us do. There's potential for its use in state-to-state wars. Cruise missiles will do damage to other navies. They'll tear shit up. But there's not really that much more incentive. Presidents don't go flying cruise missiles willy-nilly. We considered it in Syria. There was a big incident in August, late August, early September, where we almost shot cruise missiles at Syria. But that's really the extent of what a new platform will let us do. I personally don't lend a lot of credence to the technology makes us more willing to go to war thing. It might make us more willing to like shoot a few missiles every now and then, but that's really...
I think that, and again, I don't necessarily subscribe to this view, but I think the argument is more along the lines of technology makes us more willing to define down what war is in the first place.
Yes.
And I think that I think what you get with a drone that you don't get with a cruise missile that fuels the... perversely, in my view, fuels the it's easier to go to war with this, is that a drone gives you an up-to-the-second situational picture of what's going on the ground. But as Kelsey mentioned, that's really only driven by the quality of the intelligence you have to put that drone feed into a broader context. If you see a guy digging along the side of the road in Afghanistan, well, you could, if your intelligence says, hey, somebody's going to go place an IED tonight, you could reasonably conclude, hey, that dude's probably planting an IED. On the other hand, if you have really good intelligence, you might find out that that guy's just a farmer and he's just trying to dig an irrigation ditch and he probably doesn't deserve, you know, a javelin missile coming after him.
And this is the big problem here, is the failing is, in a lot of cases, that we don't have the intelligence for it. But this is, again, this is what happens in counterinsurgency war generally. That's how this conflict works, is it's a lot of figuring out intelligence, figuring out the key details of these things. And then we have the drones there, and we have one of the advantages to drones flying a long time is they can watch a target for a long time to see if we can hopefully find them.
Yeah.
If we can watch the person we know is a courier make it to the house, then we have more reasonable suspicion. It's a weird, messy process, and a lot of it is secret. But that's... I don't think it makes us go to war itself easier. I think it makes some actions in war easier.
In yeah, definitely.
Is my phrasing.
I think that is the thing that is new about... You know, people say, okay, well, drones are not in and of themselves new technologies. It's really not a new technology to strap a snowmobile engine to the back of a glider and then put essentially a wide bandwidth sat phone on the back of it. And a camera.
It's worth mentioning that the Predator is a prop plane. Like, yeah. The construction of it, the way it's steered,
that's right.
There's a lot new. The camera on it is new. The data link is new. The pusher propeller on an airplane was an idea we tried for fighters in World War I that was outdated by 1916.
And the Hellfire missile that these things pack, although we're putting new ones on there, we've actually, the history of warfare tends to be about building a bigger bomb than the other guy. We're now really sort of fighting to see who can make the smallest bomb that we can strap on board, you know, a Predator, you know, so they get smaller and smaller so we can do more precision strikes. Go ahead.
I'm sort of curious. I mean, you mentioned the camera. If I understand the role of a pilot in an F-14, he doesn't really see the outcome of what he's done, right? He drops the bomb, he flies off.
Right.
But now with the drone, it almost seems like the pilot now has the intimacy of war that maybe a soldier or an insurgent would have. An actual
pilot and sensor operator, yeah.
Right, an actual participant. So I'm sort of curious. I mean, does
more PTSD?
Yeah.
That's it?
That, I mean, and that's not like that's it. That's
no, I mean,
big.
Right. No, I mean, yeah.
But that's a true thing. Is that drone pilots? The other quip that I the trope I am most annoyed with in drone writing, besides people trying to make the acronyms a thing, is that drones are video game warfare.
Stop making RPA try to happen. It's not going to happen.
RPA, no. Remotely piloted aircraft. Sorry.
But the is that drones aren't video game warfare. They are controlled. They are controlled by screens and a joystick. That much is true, but the pilots are the pilot and the sensor operator. That's what the Predator has. They're watching a village for 2 weeks, probably. That's their 8-hour shift a day. Going to work, fly that plane over that village.
And watch
there'll be other people
village.
And watch that village. Watch the this house, watch this compound, watch the children play
it's
in
the
background.
Game of the Sims ever.
It's like the Sims, and there's no way you can say maybe you shouldn't take the money from that guy.
Oh.
Maybe you should try farming.
Yeah, maybe oh you boy. Maybe you should. Seriously,
that's
maybe
really
you
that's
take those ten bucks from that guy to go plant an IED.
There's like I mean maybe you're off. Maybe there's something else. Maybe this is why can't we tell like the eight? There's complicated. The game they play, the thing they are doing, is they are watching. A selected site. This is for the targeted killing program mainly, but the other situations too. They're watching a site and they're figuring out when the right circumstances have met, checking up through the chain of command, and then they're pressing the trigger, and then they're watching the people that they've watched for weeks. And that's traumatic. It's obviously not to say that their pain is worse or anything else than the people getting shot, getting blown up, but we ignore that drone warfare has a human cost for us too, and that we've had more chaplains stationed at the bases in Nevada mainly, or otherwise where we say this, there's more counseling and there's more cases of PTSD than there are for other pilots who get their mission, fly over the target, drop the bomb, and are gone. When you have that intimacy of watching the target for weeks and then pressing the trigger, or and then watching the other people in the
there's an enormous degree of kind of unquantified psychological impact.
And
on
there's
this.
There's
that GQ article that was written about a sensor operator from the Air Force who really suffered a lot of pretty serious consequences from the stuff that he saw.
And then there's a couple. The New York Times has at least a couple really good articles on this. The distinguished service medal was the one they were joking about there. There was a joke about there was a considered medal for drone pilots announced about March of last year, and one of the few cases in its favor was that there is actually more psychological damage to drone pilots than anyone is really giving credit for.
Well, I want to sort of switch topics a little.
Certainly.
So I work in IT and sort of like repair and sort of dealing with this particular office's, you know, computer-based shit. And, you know, the staff, we've sort of developed, you know, a sort of mantra catchphrase. And that's, you know, the hardware is great, but software is shit. That you're, you know, 90% of your failings in an organization will be software-based. Windows, Apple, Linux, whatever. So I'm sort of curious, you know, when we apply this to the drones, I mean, is there an attempt to make drone software more secure? I mean, is there somebody at the DoD or NSA or DISA thinking about this?
I really hope so.
Yeah, I hope so, too. There's sort of been two really dramatic stories of drone security failure. One has been that we figured out that for a couple of years, insurgents in Afghanistan and maybe Iraq as well had figured out how to tap into Predator video feeds that were going out in the clear. So we were sending Predators out to watch these guys, and these guys were tuning in like it was Downton Abbey. Like, they could watch themselves being watched from the Predator feed because we had such a lax approach. I mean, obviously security costs time and money and bandwidth and, you know, programming expertise. And the other was, of course, what is reported to be the GPS spoofing of the RQ-170 drone by Iran that went down in, was 2010 or 2011? I don't remember when it was, but it was a few years ago. So I think that the big honking vulnerability for the current generation of drones seems to be the data links. The fact that you have to send a lot of very sensitive information over very long distances, and any corner you cut could be exploited by a potential adversary.
And the corner that was cut with Predators, and I believe it's not cut anymore, but I don't know enough to say for sure, was that we didn't encrypt the feed.
Right.
Because encryption is slow, and then de-encrypting is slower still, and that was too much lag time between the video and the person controlling it, and we wanted to have it through the seconds, so we just left the feed unsecured.
Which, to be fair, probably saved a few Predator airframes, because when they were landing it, that latency is often what's blamed for for crashes that happen on landing and takeoff. But, you know,
I mean, is there a possible thesis that the adversaries that we use drones against don't have the wherewithal and the money to develop, to sort of hack drones?
That's certainly the underpinning of the assumption that we had going in with both the RQ-170, where you had Iran spoofing the navigation system, and the Predator, you know, picking. We never expected the Taliban to be hacking a feed that was intended for, you know, a little rover.
But it's a real shitty military plan that relies on underestimate the enemy for security.
Yeah. It's not a wise approach, but especially when you're fighting some like a war like Iraq, where there was such a demand for this. I mean, as soon as Iraq really took a southward turn, the demand from ground force commanders for Predator and Reaper ISR feeds was overwhelming. I mean, these things were the Furby of the aerospace world. I mean, they were sold out. There were nowhere near enough UAVs for the demand that combatant commanders had for, you know, for their ground forces. They needed that eye in the sky.
I mean, they adopted others. They made the Raven, which is a backpackable one that it's hilarious. It's steered very much like a remote control thing. Throw it in the air like a javelin, it flies around for a little bit, and then it crashes and falls apart like Legos. But that was a thing, because that's like the commander needed something to see immediately around the corner and wanted a drone, and you couldn't get drones to everybody, so they made a drone you could throw that would see around the corner.
One. Okay, and we're back. So that the first part was sort of dark and sort of awful.
So we're gonna edit that down.
We're going to switch to something a little more fun, and that's drones in the domestic context. So I want to start off with, like, privacy, because I think this is the strongest, not the strongest, but sort of the, you know, combination loudest and sort of most sensible argument I've heard, and that's, you know, using UAVs in a domestic context is a violation of privacy. And then there's a lot of shades to this and a lot of sort of points to this, but I want you to sort of walk us through this argument, because, you know, in our pre-conversation, you did highlight, like, this idea of, you know, the police using a UAV for surveillance and that UAV collecting incidental information. So license plates that's, you know, come into the frame accidentally. And then, you know, the most exaggerated argument I've heard is that, you know, drones will collect all your information 10 times worse than Google.
Yeah.
But sort of walk us through the contours of this debate.
Well, I think one of the concerns that gets, one of the images that people bring up advocating for privacy protections from domestic drone usage is the idea that the police department would hang some drone over, you know, Second in Massachusetts. Oh, just gave away our location. Oh, well. The police department would hang a drone over some D.C. intersection. And
wow, you just...
would
not only gave the address, but also the city.
So. Well, I don't know. Well, Second in Massachusetts might be in the Boston area, I suppose. But anyway.
We're the OPSEC, bro.
Yeah, my big OPSEC fail right now. Anyway, the fear being that the police department could put a drone over some highly trafficked or even not highly trafficked area and bring kind of the vacuum cleaner approach to surveillance, which is that they would just aggregate vast quantities of data on the license plates of the cars driving by, the facial recognition imprints of the people walking down the street, whatever it might be. And I think that's pretty unlikely, both from a practical perspective, that the police department has no real interest or use for that, and also that the resources required to collect and store and analyze that are massive, and modern police departments don't have them. What is a little bit more realistic, and what you hear being brought up now by some of the domestic privacy advocates, is the concern that, let's say, you know, you have a local police department, I'm just saying perhaps the Grand Forks Sheriff's Department in North Dakota, gets called out to a hostage barricade situation where you have a bad guy in a house with a gun holding people hostage, and they bring out a drone because it's smaller and cheaper and a little more nimble as a surveillance platform, and they put that up in the air and they keep an eye on the house. What the Electronic Privacy Information Center or the ACLU, I certainly don't speak for them, but I suspect what their argument might be is that there need to be regulations, rules, laws, policies, whatever, in place to make sure that, say, I, as that SWAT commander, when I'm gathering data on that house where that hostage situation is, mm-hmm. that if you drive by and my drone gets your face or your license plate or some other piece of information about you, that incidental data collection doesn't get recorded in a way that I, as law enforcement, can later make use of, because they can consider that to be a privacy violation.
So it's funny you mentioned Grand Forks.
Yeah, it's weird. I just picked a random law enforcement agency, Kelsey.
So I took a trip to Grand Forks at the behest of the North Dakota Department of Commerce. They got their money's worth. So... So Grand Forks...
Yeah.
So Grand Forks, North Dakota, is the third largest city in North Dakota, which means it's 50,000 people. It's not the kind of place that ever before had a police helicopter. Which is one of the things is that we talk about, like, I've lived in D.C., other places, like, major cities have their own. Police can get cameras from the sky if they need them, usually. But not in a small city like Grand Forks. So, what they have now is they have small ones. I think the Dragon Flyer, it's made by a company in Saskatchewan.
Yep.
It's hilarious. But it fits in the trunk. You can set it up in about 10 minutes. And before North Dakota was recently named an FAA test site, but before that, the University of North Dakota, which is the one in Grand Forks, had a special permission from the FAA. It was a smaller test site. The whole state's one now, but before that, the FAA one gave this permission to the university, and they had a drone program, and they worked with the sheriff's department to use their drones. And the way they set it up is they have, it's really interesting because it's governed by a university, so it has a university ethics board, research ethics board reviewing it, which means they have to think of not just the immediate impact and the, like, what they can do legally, but also the long-term implications. And it's university professors doing it, so they're really, really good.
It's like an IRB.
Right, yeah, it's in fact exactly that. It is one of, it. Yeah, that's what it is. And so they have a couple things from that. They had a big concert. They have a really good hockey team there. They have a really big hockey arena. They had a concert at this hockey arena one summer, so 10,000 extra people were going to come to Grand Forks, so that the town would gain a sixth of its population, or a fifth of its population again. And they wanted to use the drone to help manage traffic for this concert. But they met with the committee met and figured out how they could do it, because the people were really concerned about a drone flying overhead for the police, just taking pictures of everybody, and then just having that information forever. So the way they figured it out is that they were allowed to use it to direct traffic, but they couldn't take pictures. They could take pictures of license plates, but not people. And they could use it for the duration of the event, but they weren't going to store what they filmed. Because storage is something that, like, we think of, like, electronic surveillance, like, the way that Google or Facebook collect things, or the NSA scoops what Google and Facebook collect, those organizations have the resources to maintain servers indefinitely and choose to, and could have all the video they ever wanted forever for whatever. It's negligible to them. The Grand Forks Sheriff Department does not have those resources, and so it doesn't use them. One of the things it is that it wasn't realistic for them to keep it, and it was in their interest not to anyway. So they figured that out for like managing the traffic event. Another thing they did, and say you have the SWAT scenario, right? There's a man in a house, and he's in the neighborhood, and you want to use the drone to scoop it, but this is North Dakota. It's not really a particular bastion of strong government or that, and they're really not particularly happy with people peeking into their backyards generally. What the review board said they have to do is they have to do a reverse 911 call where the police department calls the houses in the area, sections off an area on their map, and they call people to say that they're going to be using an unmanned aircraft, and that you should and implied in that statement when they're calling, and I heard this from one of the people in charge of drones with the sheriff's department himself, is so that people could take their plants inside for while the drone was over.
What plants in particular?
What plants could that particularly be? But the point is that they want to use the...
I thought it was. they're taking their tulips inside?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't think they mean their tulips.
Their diesel.
That's really interesting.
So, because what they're looking for is they don't want to use the drone to incidentally catch crimes. And this is, again, one sheriff's department. It's a good model.
It may not be sustainable for urban areas,
but for towns that size or smaller, it works amazingly. But you could do it where... But they have an agreement now where they're figuring out... Where this town right now is figuring out what to do with police drones, because police have drones. They've had them. They've had them since March of 2013, and they, as last I knew, in November, they'd used them 7 times. But this is just a fact of life there now, is that the police are using drones. And that was a way to figure out and to negotiate the privacy boundaries there. It'll be really different when NYPD starts using them.
Yeah, that was my next question. What happens when you start using them in, like, Boston, like New York, L.A.?
Well, let's try Seattle. Everybody is as forward-thinking as Grand Forks with an advisory board. With an advisory board and, you know, public review and input and reverse 911. I think it's interesting about the idea of take your plants inside, that the vast majority of significant Supreme Court cases on aerial surveillance actually came from people who sued over saying, my Fourth Amendment rights have been infringed upon because you caught me with marijuana by flying an airplane over my house. And the FAA seems to grant broad authority under those Supreme Court decisions to law enforcement agencies. But anyway, they tried this in Seattle, and the Seattle Police Department said, hey, I think we're going to use a DHS grant, and we're going to buy ourselves a drone. And the whole city lit itself on fire. People were furious.
And they didn't.
I mean, the Seattle Police Department, I think, they were very focused on the technical capabilities that the platform afforded them. It was they weren't talking about buying a damn Predator. I mean, they were going to get a relatively small quad rotor that could do event and, point incident surveillance.
Right.
And same thing, I think, Alameda County in California. The Alameda County Sheriff's Department was going to at least consider purchasing a drone, and there was a groundswell of local opposition against it. Again, heavily influenced from the international application of drones where they spy on people and blow stuff up, which tends to tick off the local citizenry. Seattle and Oakland, their law enforcement really wanted to do a very basic, just kind of, this is less expensive than a helicopter, why not? And didn't realize they were wading into a national conversation, and unlike Grand Forks, they really flubbed it.
I mean, is there a conflation then? I mean, every time you mention... You know, drones over Seattle, drones over Oakland, there's the immediate, Predator, you invoke the Predator, the Global Hawk, these systems that are being used overseas. I mean,
this is the thing when I'm, so I write about this, I write about these issues, and the drone beat is the mass majority of what I cover. And it's really important to get the exact drone right. There have been stories where, for a long time, people were writing stories where the picture they were using of a predator was a photoshopped, like, mess. Was just a, like, it was the first Google hit on, it was the first Google image result. And so people, there's not people taking it a lot seriously when they're writing about it. It's really easy to write sloppy about drones. And people will put a predator op, like a predator op, and then talk about domestic drones. When really, what they should be talking about is something like a DJI Phantom.
Yeah. It's not totally nonsense. The idea of a predator being used domestically is not totally insane. Because if you live near the border, occasionally Customs and Border Protection will respond to requests from local or state law enforcement to assist. And, but this is the exception that proves the rule. That right. This almost never happens. And what and you will, you know, a photo editor on a website being like, oh, okay, well, why don't we just, what's our drone photo? What's our drone stock photo?
Right.
They go to the stock photo of the Predator drone when they're looking at something that, you know,
2 feet. Could, 2 feet big camera.
Could, you know, fit in the glove box of your car.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it doesn't do, there are two very separate sets of policy questions on targeted killing and the projection of American force abroad and transparency that, you know, transparency and the authorities that underpin it. And then there are questions about domestic privacy. I wrote an article about this a long time ago, so I'm semi-plugging it. But there is, and then you have the domestic issues of privacy and data retention, and we haven't even gotten to data retention by non-state organizations. I mean, I think everybody is rightfully concerned about what happens if local or state or federal law enforcement has access to a platform, you know, like a Predator drone or all the way down to a DJI Phantom. But very few people are talking about the capacity for private sector, for commercial applications of this, where, you know, people are afraid of the NSA, but they'll freely give their information to Amazon or Google. Well, the commercial applications for drones are probably going to vastly outstrip the public sector applications
right.
thereof, because they're going to be far less rigidly regulated, because you'll be able to point to what the drone is doing and say, this is doing something good for you. You can, you know, a vineyard in Napa can say, we have drones that are going to help us wine in a more environmentally friendly manner.
It can watch the vineyard one. That's a good one. This is something they've actually done. You can see the coloration of the leaves and the vines, and if they're lighter, they haven't gotten enough water, and you can find out that I didn't know I had more richer groundwater here at the bottom of this hill and the top of this hill, and then the middle is where, and you can like harvest grapes sooner. That's a very straightforward thing, but there you have a surveillance drone flying overhead over private property.
Can you think of anything beyond agriculture?
Oh, TMZ is the one that worries me.
Ah,
yeah.
What happens when TMZ
is going to be bad news? Now, on the other hand, there's stuff that's obviously very beneficial. There is patrolling pipelines for saboteurs and leaks to make sure that you're not dumping crude oil. There is, you know, search and rescue applications.
My favorite is anti-poaching.
Anti-poaching has been very popular in Africa.
But I mean, that's very what you're describing. I mean, at least for the commercial aspects, I mean, setting TMZ aside.
We didn't even touch Amazon.
Delivery is a big thing.
Yeah.
But isn't that more gimmick than anything? I mean, they were sort of...
I mean, that was an incredibly well-timed...
That was free publicity. Yeah.
It was infomercial, yeah. For
Amazon.
Like, right before Christmas, think about Amazon delivery.
But
delivery drones are a thing. They're not necessarily the best case. They don't do bulk really well yet, but they can do difficult-to-reach routes. They could do... I imagine that a rural delivery could be done easier that way, honestly.
Well, they're doing it in Afghanistan right now, the K-MAX helicopter.
Right.
The Marine Corps, they have had a test program with two K-MAX helicopters, which are optionally manned aircraft. It's a great term. actually, my favorite is the abbreviation they came up with them. They called them a UAT, for an unmanned aerial truck, which I love.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, so the K-MAX helicopter is basically just a heavy lift cargo helicopter that can lug pallets of stuff. And they've been using it to fly missions to remote marine fire bases in Afghanistan for the last 2 years. And they can't get enough of them. They are very successful. So we know we can do unmanned rotary wing delivery aircraft if you've got a Defense Department-sized budget. But I think, as the former head of FedEx said, maybe in like 2009, he was quoted in Peter Singer's book on this, the real money, the real future in cargo drones is going to be for the real, for unmanned from the ground up, specially designed heavy lift cargo drones moving stuff across continents or across like the Pacific.
Right.
Because that's where, you know, fleets of those, that's where you're going to save money.
The stuff that really isn't worth putting, the thing that is the least, the thing we want to get human pilots out of the most is really long, boring hauls. I mean, imagine when Google figures out Google driverless cars for people are cool, they'll be really good for truckers.
Yeah.
When Google...
Well, they'll be bad for truckers.
Well, they'll be bad for truckers. They will be good for trucking.
Yeah, they'll be great for trucking.
But, like, it's... People get tired, get exhausted, they get bored, and you don't really want people steering vehicles when that's the case. And if you can have people doing that when they're flying long hauls, 14-hour flights across the Pacific or the Atlantic, that's really where you'll get a lot of gains of merit. I read something, there's a lot of unmanned stuff that overlaps. It isn't strictly drone, like driverless cars. Those are obviously ground and not flying. Or there's, Rolls-Royce is working on unmanned cargo ships because cargo crews take up, because feeding and sustaining people on boats is expensive.
It's expensive.
Why not have the boat steer itself
right.
if you can? And that's really what we're going to see.
But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, I don't know if...
I mean, that's
was,
scary. I mean,
well,
all this stuff being put up to software and automation is sort of...
It's, well,
somebody
like
works
said, it's
software.
Only as good as, it's only as good as the people who code it. But
I mean,
I think I'll, for at least for the foreseeable future, whether it is for cargo aircraft or whether it is for quad rotors doing high-tension power line inspections or... crop dusting. You will have some opportunity. There may not be a human actively involved in flying it, but there will be a human on the loop in an oversight capacity who's able to, when the aircraft says, you know what, you wrote this much in terms of programming for me, but I've hit something like this storm or this visual obstruction or whatever it is that I'm really not prepared to deal with. The software ought
makes
to
them sound whiny.
Yeah, whiny, needy.
Some of them
are. I mean, I think if you
the storm,
fire scouts could stand to whine a little bit more.
Yeah, fire scouts could really stand to do. And I think they had one EOD team in Iraq that whenever it got close to any kind of cell phone tower, the thing would just start acting wonky. So they start calling it Rain Man the robot. Like, yeah, it's an excellent driver. Yeah. For the foreseeable future, whatever autonomy we cede these systems is going to be driven primarily by human failings like laziness and sleepiness, and the same way we put autopilots into, you know, large aircraft that are full of paying customers. The era of the truly autonomous system is still pretty far off.
Absolutely.
So I want to sort of end the interview with addressing drone hysteria. Like, what makes, like, when you present drones to people, what makes them freak the fuck out? Like, I don't, like, I'm very puzzled by this because I watch, like, good friends at EFF, you know, like, have Twitter feeds dedicated to hating on drones, and yet, like, you know, they don't talk about automation in the financial market. They don't talk about stuff that could, like, seriously, you know, hurt people on a wide scale. They, you know, they choose to focus on drones, and they're very successful at it. I think they've built a very successful platform in drone hysteria, drone fearing, whatever you want to call it. But I'm sort of curious, you know, what's your take?
I mean,
on it? Why is
in
it?
Fairness, drones are linked to the policy through which most people are exposed to drones is targeted killing, and the targeted killing program, while it's had some successes, is not a fantastic policy. And it's not only not a fantastic policy, it's a really opaque policy. So whatever good reasons are there are secret, but the bad reasons are public.
Very public.
Are very, very public. And so that's a hell of a clunker to be stuck with as a foundational, as a start. That's a really bad introduction to drones.
Yeah. And I think that, as we were talking about in the pre-interview, a lot of the times drones end up as a Rorschach test for the issues that you're already concerned about. I think
if you don't want America to be engaging in dirty wars or engaging in counterinsurgency operations or supporting regimes in Yemen, fighting in Somalia, or working in Pakistan, then you're going to be mad at drones because that's how we do all of that.
Yeah.
But you're not. But really, the policy there is the problem. And then because you're mad about those drones, you're going to automatically assume, or it's likely. I don't mean to assume, but it's likely you will find that the idea of drones in the U.S. screams Orwell, screams Skynet, screams Terminator, all this mess of automation designed to hunt people down.
Yeah, I think it's, whether or not it's hysteria or it's enthusiasm really depends on the frame through which you approach it. I think Kelsey and I both went to the DARC conference in New York in October, which is the Drones and Aerial Robotics Conference. And I think it's safe to say that the room was filled with about 50-50 groups of people from two very different worldviews. You had half of the room were these bright-eyed engineers who were so enthusiastic about, can you believe what this stuff can do, with just smiles on their faces and excitement in their hearts.
There was a 14-year-old kid who had built his own.
Yeah, there was a 14-year-old kid who'd built his own drone.
And gotten off from school.
Right, and had gotten the day off school, which is impressive. But we haven't even talked about medical evacuation too much yet, but, you know, I think it's probably appropriate with the ambulance going by. But the other, so you had half of the people in this room were really excited about the ways that flying robots and flying cameras and flying sensors could make the world a better place. And you had the other half of the room filled with people who were appalled at the damage they'd already perceived these platforms had created and were very concerned about the potential for it to continue and to expand. People who wanted to, you know, an investigative journalist who produced a document about, you know, what she perceived as war crimes in the federally administered tribal areas. People who wanted to point out the potential privacy implications of drones. So I think that if this technology is going to get anywhere, then the, you know, to actually realize some of the potential right. that it has, the two groups of people that were in that auditorium in Lower Manhattan that day have to actually start talking to each other and incorporating each other's concerns. You know, I think if you are the Electronic Frontier Foundation or the, you know, EPIC or the ACLU, then you got to engage to some degree on what the socially beneficial applications of these are. And if you are an engineer, even if your whole job is just, you know, I'm going to figure out how to make this thing fly better, faster, farther, and carry more sensors and communicate more efficiently, you have to think about the implications that people might, you know, the implications that it has for privacy and civil liberties, even if you feel like that's not my freaking job.
And one of the really interesting things I've seen is that the FAA FAA has a very strong safety mandate. They were born out of a mid-air collision between airliners over the Grand Canyon. This is actually the foundational impetus behind the FAA. That was what made the agency happen. And safety is their thing. And as they've been regulating drones,
and privacy ain't.
And privacy ain't, but their roadmap, they released their roadmap to drones in America. Acknowledge the
best document ever.
It's pretty interesting, actually. Yeah,
for government produced documents, it's like way up there.
Just the title, "The Roadmap to Drones in America."
I think they may have stolen that from the Defense Department, didn't they?
I mean, everyone does roadmaps. Yeah. But they include privacy there for the first time. This is an agency who dodges these questions. They're really happy letting things below a certain altitude just fall under police jurisdiction. They've been really uncomfortable with this, but they understand that the technology itself has privacy implications, and if they're regulating if they're regulating aviation in America, they have to figure out a way to incorporate privacy, because that's now something that's much more of a concern. And I think, really, the solution people come with opinions on drones, they have their agendas, they have their what they want to get out of it, and there's a lot of begrudging acceptance that none of this is clearly cut, and that you can have the privacy concerns, but also the economic potential. You can understand that it's a really, really cool, efficient technology, but also that most people were introduced to it through a program that is best known for accidentally bombing weddings.
Yeah.
There's a lot that's complicated about it, and it's really hard to get that conversation across, and every time, it's really hard for people to say... One of the challenges of Dark was having those engineers and those journalists and privacy activists in the same room and getting to the conversation where I want to talk about what this construction drone can do, and it's really hard to have that conversation when you're talking about the innocents killed in Pakistan. And we don't need to have that same conversation every single time. We need to acknowledge that they're part of the whole thing, but also, like, move a bit beyond that. We have to bring up every single facet every single time.
Yeah. And you know, if you've ever stood outside of... this has happened to me on a couple different occasions in front of a couple different university research centers. You pass by people who will be out there waving signs, talking about how drones are immoral when the people on the inside are building quadcopters designed for search and rescue. And it's not that those folks outside are even necessarily misinformed. It's just that you know, the lens through which people view these technologies is largely determinative of, you know, whether or not you think drones are a good thing.
And if there's anything I'd like to close on, it's that the problems people have with drones, and actually the promises people say, are really, they're policy questions. The technology enables it in some way, but the technology wouldn't go in the direction if people weren't planning for it. Targeted killing has been done other ways. Crop dusting has been done other ways. The
right.
fact that drones are going to do both is because people thought that that was the technology that fit the mission, not because they suddenly had this new technology and realized that they could do this instead.
Yeah, I think as somebody who, when I go to a conference or even go out to the bar and, you know, people learn that I'm the human co-pilot for the Drunken Predator feed, I think I can safely tell you that people really do assign a lot of attributes to robotic platforms. And I think that believe me, I can tell you some stories. I suppose my only real appeal would be to everybody have a drink and have a laugh about this stuff every so often, because it does get awful serious as the first half of this interview went. But I just want to thank you guys in the Loopcast for giving me the opportunity to show up and talk to you. It's really been a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you so much, guys.